Hi, Molly.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner. I'm Associate Editor at Religion Dispatches. I'm also a Senior Correspondent for the American Prospect. And I've written about religion and politics for a number of different publications. And I'm here today with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, who's a Washington, D.C.-based writer. And Molly, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yes, very nice to be here today. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway. I'm a daily contributor to GetReligion.org. And that's a website where we analyze how the mainstream media handles religious news. And I'm also a columnist for Christianity Today. And I write about religion for a variety of outlets, including the Wall Street Journal.
Great. Well, I think we have a lot to talk about. And I'll start us off with talking about the Democratic Party and religious outreach. There was a recent article in the Washington Post by Michelle Boorstein, which talked about how the Democratic Party has abandoned doing faith outreach. It's dismantled the staff, and nothing is really going on inside the party. I just wanted to pick your brain about what you thought about that. Is this business as usual? There's a Democrat in the White House. It has its own political arm. Is it up to them to run this sort of thing? Or does it signal that the Democrats have abandoned this idea altogether?
Well, I think, one thing that happens when we talk about religious outreach is people sort of lose all perspective. And it's probably helpful to remember that it was only 5 years ago that George W. Bush had won re-election, and everyone on the editorial pages was freaking out about the impending theocracy and the takeover of the religious right. And so it was into that mix that Democrats realized that they had a values voter problem that they wanted to address, and they really put the effort forth at that point, and they did really good work. I mean, they elected a slew of people in 2006 and 2008. It's not that also Democrats have trouble reaching out to religious voters. They've always had the vote of the religious left. So what we're really talking about is more the outreach to people who might be with the Democrats on certain issues but had trouble voting for them because of the stance the party has taken on abortion or other moral issues. So they did a really good outreach. They had all these blue dog Democrats winning office in key districts. And so I think it's just important to remember that the environment is a little bit different now. It's not like people are worried about how the Republicans have so much control and how that's all been on the back of religious voters, because, of course, the Republicans have no control on anything. And, they're sort of in a rebuilding phase. And
well,
so
they have an obstructionist control, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing what they can with what they have, I guess. But it's not quite the same situation. And so I think you would have to expect that outreach would be a little bit different. But I actually found the Boorstein article somewhat convincing. I mean, it seemed like by whatever metric you judge it, that the outreach has really kind of gone way down. And it might be a problem considering the polling data that suggests that Democrats have an uphill battle for this next election.
When you talk about that they elected in 2006 and 2008 a slew of good candidates, are you talking about people who were, represented by, Mara Vanderslice's shop, Good Common Good Strategies? She now works at the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, or Bernd Strider's group, the Eliasson Group. Are you talking about people who were helped along in reaching out to? I hate to say religious voters, because there are lots of different kinds of religious voters.
Right, right.
But are you talking about those candidates?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's probably more the type of voters that the Eliasson Group reached out to, which I've learned through your reporting, is different than some other Democratic outreach to religion groups. And so we're talking about more blue dog Democrats, people who, I mean, it's the whole reason why Democrats are in power. It's not the whole reason, I should say. It's a big reason why Democrats are in power, is that they were able to get some of these districts that had been solidly Republican by running pro-life Dems, or, Dems who were a little bit more moderate on other issues. And I actually think that that's part of the story right now, too. I'm curious what you think about this, but you elect people who run the gamut from pretty strongly pro-choice to solidly pro-life, and it's kind of difficult to manage that coalition. And within, a few months of having power, you were already seeing these battles over abortion funding and healthcare and whatnot. So maybe it's just more difficult to convince the traditional religious voters that you, you know, you can do good work on their pet issues of pro-life causes or whatnot after they've just gone through the big healthcare battle that we went through.
Or on the flip side of that, I wonder if the Democrats were dismayed by some of these blue dogs who were elected in part, maybe. I mean, I'm not even sure that the evidence is there that they were elected because of their religious outreach, but because some of them voted for this Tupac Amendment and then also voted against healthcare reform. And one of them, Parker Griffith, even switched parties. So, you know, from the Democrat standpoint, you wonder, well, you know, maybe that wasn't even worth it.
Right. Like, why are we reaching out to these people if they're just jumping ship? Right. Well, that's the real challenge. I mean, Republicans, for whatever other problems they have a lengthy experience with having people who are pro-choice and pro-life in the same party. And they've sort of figured out how it works. You know, you're allowed to vote pro-choice if you want to, but don't ever try and change the platform. And I'm actually curious, is that now that Democrats are getting more experience with this, of course, Democrats used to have quite a few pro-lifers and then they all kind of went away. And then the last few years we saw a bigger tent there. Is it going to be that people figure out after what happened with healthcare that there's just no room for pro-lifers in the Democratic Party, or are the Democrats going to figure out how to put people with wildly different views in the same party, and how are they going to do that?
Well, who are the pro-choice Republicans that you're thinking of?
Just all those, you know, Northeast Republican elitists.
Are there any left?
You know. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's in fact, I would say there are many more pro-choice Republicans in leadership than there are pro-life Democrats in leadership.
Like who?
I'm sleep deprived and I'm not coming up with any names, but I've seen stuff that shows that that the Republicans have a broader diversity on the abortion topic in their leadership than Democrats have.
Because I mean, I think that the leadership is pretty solidly anti-abortion.
Yeah,
you know, you look at Boehner and McConnell. You know,
right now there are so few of them.
Eric Cantor. It doesn't seem like there's anybody. I can't even think of anybody in the caucus who is.
Well, what about? I mean, I'm just talking about committee chairs or whatnot. I'm sure. I mean, is Susan Collins heading a committee, or you know, is she a ranking person? She would
be a good example. Harry Reid self-identifies as pro-life.
I think very few people believe that one, given his voting record. But
well, I think that one of the things that the Democrats tried to do with regard to all of, and this was, I think, the linchpin of the religious outreach effort, was this discussion about finding common ground on abortion. And so let's not argue anymore about whether it should be legal or not legal, and let's not fight over Roe anymore. Let's try to figure out ways to reduce the need for abortion. That's the pro-choice framing, or the number of abortions. That's the pro-life framing. And I'm not sure how that, I mean, there was a lot of expectation from the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, for one, probably more from there than from the congressional side, that there was going to be something done in that regard. And I think that I wonder to what extent the whole STUPAC and healthcare reform really made that more difficult. And I haven't really seen anything come out policy-wise from the White House. And since the Ryan DeLauro bill, which, you know, lays out a lot of legislative ambitions for accomplishing that, it was introduced, but nothing has happened on it. No, there are lots of reasons why. There's been a lot of other things on the legislative agenda. But what are your thoughts about where this common ground on abortion is going and whether it's even politically feasible?
I don't know. I mean, I actually think there is some political feasibility there. I doubt that anything that gets passed will actually affect much of a change. And it's coming into a climate where there's a lot of concern about the growth of the government as is. So when you see the common ground, a lot of people are talking about, you know, increasing funding for this particular federal program or starting, you know, some other new federal program that can address some of the root causes that people say will lead to, that people say lead to abortion. But this is a really bad climate to be arguing for an expansion of government. And so I think that that could put the kibosh on some of these abortion reduction initiatives. And then, of course, the faith-based initiative office was supposed to come up with a plan, and I've heard nothing. No one's heard anything.
Right.
Because I don't think that office is, you know, and some people will say this is a great thing. I don't think that office is being terribly productive, and I don't think that the method they chose for addressing some of these larger issues has been terribly fruitful. And I think it's, you know, they're put people together for 1 year terms and you have a meet once every couple of months to hash out stuff. I mean, it's not going to, I wonder how realistic any suggestions that do eventually come out are going to be.
Well, let's return to that in a minute, because something you said about the political infeasibility of some of these common ground proposals, just because of what you describe as opposition to government, you know, increasing government programs, because I want to return to the faith-based office, because I think that, you know, it's a good thing for us to talk about today. But, you know, the National Association of Evangelicals has come out recently with an abortion reduction agenda, and in conjunction with that, issued a pamphlet called The Theology of Sex. And I think probably for a lot of people, probably not for you and me, but I think a lot of people might be surprised to find out that the National Association of Evangelicals is even talking about sex. But in light of the fact that this organization, which has, you know, largely been seen as allied with the Republican Party, is putting out this abortion reduction strategy, how interested do you think either the Republicans or the Democrats are going to be in what the evangelicals are doing with this, or is it just window dressing?
I don't know. I mean, I'm deeply cynical and skeptical about all of these political machinations. I've sort of assumed that people figured out that the language of abortion reduction is really popular on both left and right, and so both sides are going to try and get a piece of the pie and sound nicer when they're talking about one of the most contentious issues, you know, that is in our culture right now. But on the other hand, I really, you know, I think that there's reason to expect that both sides would have a vested interest in reducing abortion or reducing the need for abortion. And so I could see some stuff happening. But that theology of the sex document isn't, I mean, it's a really long ball game approach to abortion reduction, if you will, because it's, you know, it's taking a 30,000 foot view of trying to address how people think about sex and think about their bodies and think about what the purpose of sex is and what the natural result of sex is frequently. And I do think that that's actually, that's, you know, courageous and good and important and about 40 years too late. and it's funny to think about, you know, they say that the Vatican moves in terms of centuries and not days,
right.
But the Vatican put out their theology of the body however many decades ago when Pope John Paul II had his you know, important document that helped people think about all the ramifications of what the church teaches about the body. And I think it's funny that the way that the evangelicals move, so they sort of jump into the public square and they say what they think about all these things. And then they back up and they say, we're going to look at the theology of sex. And we're going to think about what we think about what the Bible has to say about sex. But they sort of start in the public square and then they back up and think about having a religious defense. Whereas a lot of other religious groups might start their interest based on their own religious views and then think about whether they have something to say in the public square or whether those are particular views to their own religion.
Well, I kind of, you know, reading the theology of sex, it in many ways reminded me of the Manhattan Declaration, but it was sort of perhaps kinder and gentler than the Manhattan Declaration. But it, in many ways, it wasn't different. It was basically saying that sex is for married straight people. And I think one difference with from the Manhattan Declaration was I think it was more straightforward that sex is not solely for reproduction and that sex can be pleasurable for a couple, but they limited that to, they limited what they considered an ethical manifestation of that to married straight people.
Right. See, I thought those documents were very different because the Manhattan Declaration is something that you don't have to be Christian to sign on to necessarily, whereas that National Association of Evangelicals document was like you couldn't get through a phrase without seeing a Bible passage quoted. And I think that shows a fundamental difference in the approach. And I think that sometimes it doesn't look different to an outsider, but the people behind the Manhattan Project are saying we need to have an approach to arguing for traditional marriage, let's say, that is something that you can believe or reject whether or not you are a member of our religious tradition, whereas the, you know, NAE document is solely targeted at Christians and evangelical Christians.
It's solely targeted at evangelicals, but I feel like the Manhattan Declaration was pretty much targeted at Christians, whether they were Catholic, evangelical, Protestant, or Eastern Orthodox tradition. And I thought they were pretty upfront about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why it was signed by religious leaders, certainly. But the whole basis there is arguing from a natural law approach, saying, you know, just reason. We believe these things about marriage for a reason, and these reasons are this, that, and the other. Whereas the NAE document isn't an appeal to reason, it's an appeal to scripture. And one of those is going to have, in my view, a much how do you spread the NAE message on the theology of the body to a public square that might be hostile to a particular Christian approach to these issues? Whereas the Manhattan document, I mean, that's much more, I think, intense and saying we are coming at this from a particular philosophical perspective and, you know, take us on rationally, or, you know, don't dismiss us just as religious zealots who have a particular view.
Well, I think that, I mean, they were taking a much stronger position. I mean, I think that what the NAE document was aimed at doing was basically saying, look, you know, we're not afraid to talk about sex. We will only, you know, talk about it in this particular way. But maybe if we talk about these issues, then we can get at this abortion reduction thing in the way that we want to get at it, which I think is different than the way that the pro-choice side would want to get at the abortion reduction question, you know, which the pro-choice side has done through, you know, talking about comprehensive sex ed and providing contraception and so on and so forth. And I think that the Manhattan Declaration was very much, and I think that the NAE document seemed to be aimed at provoking conversation, whereas the Manhattan Declaration was very confrontational,
right,
talking about, well, you know, we're going to engage in civil disobedience if the law does not conform to our religious views. And it kind of took it to a different place in terms of the injection of religion into politics in the public square than the NAE document was doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of what I was talking about with how the Manhattan Declaration is just so much, it's such a bigger thing. And I think what you're really seeing there too is that, you know, and I'm not that old, but I remember there was a time when some of the debates that we were having about sex or marriage would have been unheard of. And very quickly we've gone from working on laws to decriminalize homosexual acts to now talking about the very nature of marriage. And that happened very quickly. It caught a lot of people by surprise. And a lot of people never even thought about why they thought what they did about marriage. Like there's a sort of an instinctual thing that a lot of people have, or a cultural idea that crosses pretty much every culture, space, time, you know, no matter what the religion or the era, that marriage is a heterosexual union. And very quickly that's been thrown into question. And a lot of people didn't think about why they believed what they believed. And so there's a need to discuss why have people throughout all time, you know, even if marriage looked very different, if it was polygamous or if it involved you know, people being married against their will. You know, it had a lot of different looks to it, but it was always a heterosexual union. Why is that? And a lot of people haven't thought about it. And so, you know, if you're gonna have public policy debates about changing that from a strictly heterosexual union into something that includes gay couples, then, you know, it's good to probably have a discussion about why society has always viewed it one way. And that's what the Manhattan Declaration, I think, is about, and saying this is really important and we really need to have this discussion and we need to protect religious liberties along the way.
But do you agree with the central premise of it, that religious liberty is impeded by gay marriage or abortion rights or the other things that they talked about in that document?
I think particularly with the issue of same-sex marriage, it's a huge collision course between religious liberties and gay rights. I think that people on all sides would agree with that. It's really, you know, you look at what happened when Washington, D.C., where I live, just legalized same-sex marriage, and it quickly forced some religious issues. You know, how do Catholic charities interact with the government? Do they have to stop interacting with the government, you know, when they're working on charity work? How do they protect their particular doctrinal views when it comes to following the law about providing benefits to partners? I mean, it's a really tangled, messy thing, and it's going to be, that's where the collision is. And, you know, if you're from the perspective of saying that same-sex marriage is good and should be legal, you say, well, yes, we want, you know, if you're a bigot, you should, as they would say, then you shouldn't be getting federal funding for that. And from the perspective of people who, you know, care more about sort of people who think that you can interact with the government and still keep your religious liberties, you know, they're trying to figure out how to navigate that very difficult field.
Well, don't
you?
Not,
I mean, don't you think
just
it's a collision
that, you know,
course?
But it's the framing of that, you know, it's not just that, oh, if you're a bigot, you shouldn't get federal funding. It's that you're refusing to obey the law in the jurisdiction. So should you get the funding?
Right. That's why. I mean, that's why it's an important issue. I mean, people think like, you know, should same-sex marriage be legal or not? And they kind of go from a pretty emotional reaction or whatnot, and they don't think about all of the potential implications of going one direction or another. And I think it's important for people to realize, like, yeah, it's gonna affect a lot of people in a lot of different ways. I mean, from our insurance structure to, you know, to how public schools teach about these issues, and it's probably worthwhile to think about these things.
Well, I guess, you know, I obviously come at it from a different perspective than you do. I mean, I think that, you know, these things do not impede religious liberty. I mean, there are so many conscience protections written into same-sex marriage laws, you know, where, you know, a clergy would not be required to perform same-sex wedding ceremonies if that violated their religious beliefs. And so without, you know, the law actually forcing people to do something like participate in a marriage ceremony, in a wedding ceremony, it's hard for me to see how other people getting married is going to infringe on somebody else's, unrelated person's religious liberty.
Well, this actually gets back to some of what was talked about in the Manhattan Declaration. So the basic question is, what is marriage? What is your view of marriage? Is it a union of two people of different sexes that come together, that have the natural, like, relationship that, you know, if things are ideal, would lead to procreation, children, and preserving that union so that the children are taken care of and that the wife, while she's pregnant or otherwise vulnerable, is also taken care of? Or is it just the union of two people who want to take care of each other, who pledge commitment to each other, where sex isn't really part of, you know, it's not something we need to even talk about. You know, what they do is their business. And it's a really different, those are two very different understandings of what marriage is, because a lot of what our norms are with marriage are based on the first understanding. So we think that monogamy is really important because we don't think it's a good idea if women are having children by multiple partners, because that leads to conflict within a home. We don't think it's good if men are impregnating various women, because that leaves them more vulnerable. So we have these norms of fidelity and monogamy and things that are based on sort of the biology and whatnot. And
that's a particular religious view, and there are religious views that
no, I'm just talking about.
I'm just talking about. Why would one be an infringement of somebody's religious liberty and the other week.
No. I'm just talking about what, you know, no matter where you live in the world or no matter when you lived there, why marriage has developed as a heterosexual institution. And in fact, I don't think this is a particular religious view, and I think that you could be of any particular religion or of none and take this approach just as you can be of any particular religion or none and take a different view. But if you change what the basis of marriage is in our and the societal understanding, it can have other effects. And those can, and when it gets to religious liberty, there are all sorts of things, even like, you know, there was that woman in New Mexico who was a photographer, and she decided she did not want to photograph a lesbian commitment ceremony. And New Mexico doesn't even have same-sex marriage, but the couple took her to the human rights tribunal that they have there, and they won.
Well, that's because the human rights law in New Mexico prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So that's not really an argument against gay marriage, because they weren't even actually, you know, getting married, because like you said, gay marriage isn't legal in New Mexico. So, I mean, that might have happened if they said, come photograph my birthday party, and by the way, I'm a lesbian, and then she said no.
Right. But, I mean, it's just clear to see that, you know, these issues will sort of explode even more when it comes to same-sex marriage, or the, you know, Methodist campsite that allowed a lesbian commitment ceremony in New Jersey, but they asked them not to use any of their worship space, and they lost their you know, tax status in the state of New Jersey. Now, I'm not even saying these things are, I'm not saying these things are right or wrong. It just shows that there are growing conflicts between religious liberties and you know, gay rights in general.
Well, I think in both those cases, you know, there were conservative Christian legal groups got involved in those. And so it's not necessarily a conflict between gay marriage and religious liberty, but maybe more of a political conflict with organizations with a political agenda who want to portray gay marriage in a certain way.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
Well, you know, so like the Alliance Defense Fund was very involved in the litigation in both of those cases that you cite, the New Mexico case and the New Jersey case. So, you know, you could make an argument that there's not an actual collision between the rights of these gay and lesbian couples and religion. It's been trumped up by these legal groups who want to make it a political issue.
Well, I think, you know, obviously there's a reason why groups like the ADF or the ACLU choose particular cases. They choose them because they think that they are particularly representative or winnable. And so, of course, there are other issues going on, and those you know, cases do not make, you know, don't make some of the activism on the other side look very friendly or tolerant, you know, when they see that there are, you know, is there going to be room in the public square for people who think that homosexuality is wrong or that same-sex marriage is wrong? Is there, you know, is that sort of the goal of some gay activists, to just completely drive these people from the public square? They're not allowed to, you know.
Well, I don't think that's the goal. I mean, I think the goal is for gay and lesbian citizens to have the same rights as everybody else. That doesn't mean they're driving people who think that homosexuality is wrong out of the public square.
Right, but if you can't, like, have a business photographing people, or if you can't have a campsite that, you know, has a particular tax status with New Jersey, it just makes it really difficult to, you know, you get further, you know, you're made into a fringe group, and some people are wondering, like, well, if, you know, Catholics, well, basically, if all traditional Christians are, you know, this view is somehow no longer tolerable, like, we can't even have these people, you know, expressing some of these views, I think that paints a very different picture. I mean, you saw with, like, the flash, the response to what happened in Prop 8 in California. You know, you have a vote on whether same-sex marriage should be legal or not in the state, and a lot of traditional religious groups weighed in on the matter. They felt that they had a particular interest in this issue. And then when the vote passed and you have all this vandalism and people like trying to find out who's Mormon and putting them on a blacklist, I mean, that is a very hostile environment, and it makes people wonder.
Well, don't you think it's a hostile environment to be told that you're unnatural and going to hell?
Well, I think that the whole issue is really fraught with danger and whatnot. And I think it's a really tense environment, period. I'm just saying that I think that a lot of the draw, a lot of the reason why people want to be, like, there, you know, there's been a big change in how people treat homosexuals, you know, gay couples, lesbian couples, whatnot, in the public square. And it's all based on an idea that we want to be tolerant. We want to live and let live, let people choose what they want to do with their lives. And they expect a certain response, like when they move to be more tolerant on these issues, they would also like to have that same tolerance being seen toward them and their religious views. Like, it's okay if they have views about what marriage should be or what sex should be, and they would like those to be welcome in the public square too. And we're seeing that these things are actually, you know, some people aren't able to tolerate the other side, and that's something that's not unique to one side or the other.
Well, while we're talking about religious conscience, let's segue again to the faith-based office, because one of the big issues with Obama's faith-based office, at least, was that he had made this campaign promise to end the Bush-era rule, which permitted federal funding to go to faith-based organizations that discriminated in hiring on the basis of religious belief. And civil liberties groups have been very upset that Obama hasn't changed the rule, even though he promised that he would on the campaign trail. And, you know, Eric Holder, in a congressional hearing a couple weeks ago, said something that it was sort of not particularly clear, but about whether they would change the policy or not, but sort of suggested that they, you know, they think that discrimination is wrong. But it doesn't seem like there's any move being made to change the policy. So do you think that that's a problem with the faith-based office, or do you think that the recipients of federal faith-based aid should be permitted to discriminate in hiring based on their religious belief?
Yeah, well, I am a complete opponent of faith-based initiatives and the funding of faith-based groups, and I have been since the idea was first, you know, ever since I first found out about the idea. And of course, it predates even Bush.
Right.
The first Bush had his thousand points of light.
Right.
Clinton had charitable choice. Mm-hmm. And Bush is really known for just, you know, burrowing that program into every federal agency. And I'm sure, I'm curious what you think about this, if we'll ever see the end of it. But of course, the most controversial part of that was that he said that you could discriminate in hiring.
Mm-hmm.
You can hire your co-religionist to run your religious program.
Right.
And what I think is tricky about this, and why I think that the whole idea is so terrible anyway, is of course there's a problem with federal funding when you're discriminating in hiring. And the reason why the federal government wants to get its hands on these religious charities is that they do really good work. I mean, it's probably in large part because they can be at the community level, they can tailor a program to a particular neighborhood or whatnot, and also, of course, that they are religiously motivated, they're working with their co-religionists, they are personally motivated, and also the views of their religion are brought to bear in the given program. We can't have that when you're, you know, funding at the federal level. Like, I'm sure we could all name at least one religion that we do not want funded with federal dollars and advancing a particular, mm-hmm. you know, religion. And, but yeah, nothing has changed at all under the Obama program. Not one part of any rule or regulation. And I'm wondering if you think that will change. Like, what will be the legacy of Obama's faith-based initiative office? What will his claim to fame be on what he did with federal funding of religious charities?
Well, I think that their official line is that they're looking at those cases on a case-by-case basis. So that would take somebody, presumably someone who was fired or not hired by one of these faith-based recipients of taxpayer money, coming to them or coming to, you know, the Justice Department and saying, you know, they didn't hire me because I'm gay and they're evangelical and they're opposed to homosexuality, or I'm Buddhist and they're Christian and they have a, you know, hiring policy that they only hire other Christians. It would take that, and then the faith-based office would have to take it to the Office of Legal Counsel and then to the Justice Department, and they would have to figure out whether, in that particular case, whether that discrimination was okay. Well,
right,
that's completely untenable, politically untenable, legally untenable, ridiculous.
And it was, by the way, the exact same line that the Bush White House used on the issue, too. They used the phrase case by case for how they would deal with it.
Did they really? Because I just thought that they had the executive order which permitted it, and then Obama just said he wouldn't rescind that executive order, and then he would do it case by case instead.
But you know, he did say that, but he said he would do it case by case instead. It's just that that's exactly how the Bush administration approached it too. So even though he used the word instead, it's actually just exactly the same. They said that they would deal with it. They said it, they would deal with the regulations and the rules on a case by case basis.
So, I mean, is this your only objection to the faith-based office, or do you just think the whole idea is problematic?
Well, see, I oppose it from a religious perspective. I think that it's really hard to keep your religious distinctions when the federal government applies so much pressure to you. You know, already you can imagine all the political pressure, like you can't have views that we think are, you know, dangerous or whatnot. There's if you're going to play in the public square, you kind of get all those great and interesting differences that we all have in religion watered down, and you know, there's heavy pressure to play along with other groups, and the pressure to say, so for instance, let's say your program worked really well because you had all these, you know, young Baptists going door to door on their, food drive or whatever, and now you're not allowed to hire a young Baptist. It changes the nature of the program, and I think that it's a problem for the religious groups themselves. I mean, people always think about it as worrying from the perspective of the federal funding and what that means for the federal government, but I think it's just much more sad about what happens and the pressure that's brought to bear on the particular religious organization.
But I
also think what's interesting about that program is that, you know, when it was the Bush era, we were all freaking out about how they were using that office for political outreach. That was the mm-hmm. charge. And when you would read the claims against the office, it was a really difficult case to be made. So they would say, this office is the policy office that oversees the regulations that determine who gets funding. And this policy office is teaching people how to apply for a grant. And we noticed that that policy office went to Iowa the same year there was a big election for Republicans. And so they would say, therefore, we're worried about political outreach through this office. Whereas under the Obama administration, they merged their religious liaison and their faith-based office, and now they're just using that office to call people and say, hey, we need your help passing healthcare reform. I mean, to me, that seems like such a bigger, dangerous area than it ever was under Bush, and I thought it was totally dangerous under Bush, too. But I'm wondering why more people don't care about this. I mean, don't you think that's a problem? Or
yes,
no?
I do. We actually agree on this. I think it's problematic to move the campaign. You know, we're talking about Joshua Dubois, who ran Obama's religious outreach on his campaign, and now he runs the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships in the White House. And, you know, he claims, we don't control any money, we don't give out any money to people, but, you know, obviously the White House Faith-Based Office oversees the faith-based offices that exist in about a dozen federal agencies, and they give out money. And at the same time, the White House works with different faith-based groups. Like you said, there's some, you know, intersection with getting faith-based support for different pieces of legislation. And they also work with faith-based groups. Most recently, they kicked off an initiative to try to get college students more interested in faith-based community service. And, which is fine. You know, okay, so getting college students interested in community service, okay. But do you really need a federal government, you know, the White House doing that? I mean, doesn't the White House have not better things to do, but different things to do? It just seems kind of cosmetic to me, and also because it's cosmetic, it seems political. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but also I feel like they've been horribly inefficient, but I don't want to complain too much because I'm glad that they're inefficient on some of these.
Well, I'm not even sure what it was they were supposed to be efficient in doing.
Well, remember they put up they had everyone serving on different committees to deal with the different issues like abortion reduction or whatnot, and then they, you know, we were supposed to get a report. Wasn't it like many months ago? And I don't even know.
The report was done. Actually, the advisory council, so that's 25 people from outside the White House who were appointed by the president to serve on this advisory council. And they were given, you know, half a dozen general topic areas that they were supposed to address. And the council was divided into task forces. And there were a lot of very hardworking people on the advisory council. And they developed and issued a 164-page report in, I want to say it was back in February, because they were on one-year terms and they were appointed in February of 09. Maybe, February, March was when the report was issued and nothing has happened.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm not sure if that's a bad thing, so I'm not sure if we want to criticize too much. But I'm curious also, what do you think, so if Bush's legacy was to really embed this program in the federal government, what do you think Obama's legacy will be with this? Like, I could almost see him doing some midnight regulations right at the end, although it probably wouldn't matter, to change the hiring, change the way the rule works on hiring. But since it's all done through executive order anyway, I don't think it would have that much impact. I mean, do you think there'll be anything else that he's sort of known for on this, under his office?
I don't think he will change it, because I think there's too much political pressure on him not to. And this cycles back to what we talked at the very beginning here, and that was the Democratic effort to reach kind of more conservative religious voters. I know just from my own reporting that a lot of evangelicals who were supportive of the faith-based office, and if not openly supportive of Obama's candidacy, but at least willing to work with him on different things, very much objected to him changing the hiring rule, and would in fact be no longer supportive of the faith-based office at all if the hiring rule were changed. So I think, given that that, at least in 08, and I can't imagine that it's going to be different in 2012, that one of the goals was peeling off a certain number of conservative or moderate evangelical voters and conservative and moderate Catholic voters, given that if that's a goal, I can't see it being politically tenable for Obama to change the rule. Because, you know, the civil liberties groups who want him to change the rule, you know, I mean, he knows that they're going to be on his, you know, essentially on his side anyway.
Right. Right. I think you're right.
So, well, let's talk a little bit about, is there something that you know, I feel like we have maybe five more minutes. Is there something that you really want to talk about in the last 5 minutes?
Well, I'm wondering if you saw that, that story about Ron Paul saying that he is not, a member of the Libertarian Party.
Right.
And what you think that means in terms of his, how he's trying to position himself in Kentucky and whether it's going to save the day.
Well, I think that one of the problems that someone like Ron Paul has with being identified as a libertarian is, for social conservatives, they identify that as not being opposed to abortion. Because, you know, I guess genuine libertarian would have a libertarian view on abortion and basically not have a position. So he distanced himself from the Libertarian Party, which was his father's actual original party that he ran for president on, and emphasized that he is a social conservative. So I think that he realizes that, notwithstanding the Tea Party enthusiasm in Kentucky, that Kentucky is the kind of state where you really need social conservatives to come out for you in force if you want to win a statewide election. But I think that, it raises questions about whether the religious right can, you know, make this kind of relationship with the Tea Party, which there's a lot of crossover there, I think, just in terms of activists and willingness to talk about social conservative issues and talk about religion and foundational religious issues in the Tea Party. But I do think there's still a little bit of that libertarian social conservative tension, and I think that that was clear that he was trying to navigate that.
Right. I think that might be the beauty of the Tea Party, is that, unlike, you know, for many years now, the Republicans were having trouble with the economic conservatives or the people who thought that the government was too involved in regulating, you know, various aspects of people's lives, and the social conservatives who were all about same-sex marriage or abortion and whatnot. And now you have in the Tea Party movement, if not the Tea Partiers themselves, you have support for this movement that comes from both sides, and that's because everyone is focused on the economy. So they're able to work together, not because they agree on these fundamental issues that were causing so many problems with the Republican Party in years past, but just because they all agree that there's a big problem with the size and scope of government as it relates to, you know, economic issues. But I also think, you know, just because he said he wasn't a member of the Libertarian Party doesn't mean that he couldn't in good conscience say he's a libertarian.
And right.
I'm libertarian. I've never been a member of the party and never even, you know, libertarians were a small enough group as it is. I can't imagine how small the actual party, whatever that subset is.
Right.
But there's still the tension, therefore, with the social conservatives. Like, you have people like Grover Norquist who have been trying for years to suggest that the salvation for the right can be found in something he calls the Leave Us Alone Coalition. Mm-hmm. So he says that, you know, the Christian homeschoolers and the gay couple down the street and the people who just started a business, they can all work together and no problems because they all want to be left alone by the government. And I think there's, of course, some truth to that, but American Protestants, and this applies to American Protestants and people who adopt a Protestant style of political engagement, whether this is on the left or the right, they are not interested in government leaving us alone. And I think that's one of the real interesting issues is that on both the, you know, you can actually see quite a few similarities, not between social conservatives and libertarians, but between social conservatives and social liberals, and they both seem to me to be two sides of the same coin. They really believe whatever they believe, you know, from a religious basis that the Bible or Jesus says you should do this or that. And for one side, it might be, you know, well, the Bible seems to care a lot about God's creation, so we need to pass environmental legislation. And the other side might say, well, prayer is certainly held up as an ideal, so we need to have prayer in school. And you might think those look wildly different, but what they share is a belief that you sort of need to have perfection here on earth and that the means to accomplishing that is through government action. And that's a wildly different approach than even a social conservative Ron Paul would have.
So do you think that the religious right then, socially conservative evangelicals and Catholics to a certain extent, is that compatible, do you think, with the Tea Party and with the small L libertarianism?
I think it's just as compatible now as it was in the early 80s, mm-hmm. which is compatible enough to possibly go to a winning government. I think that if you don't have a shared enemy, it's hard to organize. And so in the 80s, you had, you know, people who really hated communism because of the political liberty issue and people who hated it because they hated God. But, you know, you could work together to fight the bad communists. And then without that common enemy, everything kind of fell completely out of control. And now everyone's once again united on the economy. And you have even people who you would not consider religious conservatives, like Arthur Brooks at AEI, had that op-ed recently where he argued that concern about the economy is actually a culture war issue. It's a cultural issue.
Yeah, I thought that seemed rather opportunistic.
Well, but it does, I mean, maybe it is, but it certainly is true that the way that you conceive of your relationship with the government gets to some of the, you know, gets to really deep fundamental issues about how you view yourself and humanity. And, you know, it certainly can be a cultural issue. And it helps to explain also how there's such heat here in the Tea Party. I mean, people normally don't see this kind of concern if it's not a culture war issue. And there's a lot of there are a lot of people who are angry out there and concerned about the direction of the country.
Well, I'm sure that you saw Rand Paul on David Brody's show, and he was basically saying, well, you know, Christianity is the basis for how we should act, you know, that the government shouldn't tell us what to do. So in that respect, he's very compatible with the religious right.
Right. So maybe there is some overlap there that is heretofore unseen. I don't know.
Well, I guess on that note, I guess we'll leave it for the next time to talk about maybe some of these other issues again or further. But I want to thank you, Molly. It was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your reporting on all these issues, and hope we can get a chance to talk again.
Great. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks.
Bye.